Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really amazing, you know, founder turned investor. Well, I would say employee corporate America, then turned founder, then turned investor, and now what he's doing is pretty remarkable. So again, we're going to be learning quite a bit. We're going to be learning from his time at Netflix, some of the successful initiatives that he pushed. I mean, he's worked at some of the best companies that you can think of. I mean, Microsoft, Google, LinkedIn, Netflix. I mean, talk about resume there. And then we're going to be talking about his time while he became a partner at Andreessen Horowitz, how he went about investments, treating founders, and then also what really pushed him, you know, into now having his own gig, you know, which is basically a solo, you know, capitalist, right? I mean, he's just himself, and he already has like 225 million under management, which is kind of like unbelievable. So again, brace yourself for a very inspiring conversation. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Sal Villamoria. Welcome to the show.
All right. Thanks, Alejandro. Thanks for having me.
So originally born and raised in Indiana, but obviously, you know, like parents, immigrants' parents, which I'm sure it was incredibly inspiring for you, you know, immigrant parents from India. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Yeah, life was really interesting. You know, it was nice being next to a major city like Chicago. My parents, you know, moved here over 50 years ago from India. And the reason we picked Indiana, or they picked Indiana, is because my dad was a metallurgical engineer, so he worked at a steel company while we were growing up, but we also had a computer business as well on the side, where we would build and sell computers initially to people's homes, but then we did doctor's offices, libraries, we did the entire local school system as well, and I was conscripted child labor from age 6 onwards, helping my dad, and so I got into hardware, software, and coding at a very young age, and it was just an amazing experience, so yeah.
I know that also your dad was an entrepreneur. So how do you think that shaped you, who you are, and then also the choices that you ended up making?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, actually, that was my dad's third business as a founder. He had started two other companies beforehand and then did two other startups after in quote unquote retirement. But so he's a repeat founder himself. But, you know, that's why I chose Penn in terms of the Wharton undergrad program, because I thought I wanted to be an entrepreneur just like my dad. And I wanted to follow in his footsteps. And so had an opportunity to go there, realized that a lot of my classmates at Wharton would go into banking and consulting. And so I did internships in both, and I actually hated both of those industries. So I was very lucky that Microsoft came to campus and recruited me to be a product manager, which started my 10-year career as a PM.
Now, in your case, I mean, you've been in some of the biggest companies that one can think of, right? I mean, you've been at Microsoft, then you were at Google, Netflix, and then obviously, you know, like the more the venture side of things. So I guess, what would you say, you know, were some of the biggest things that you learned from being at a Microsoft, at a Google, or at a Netflix? What do they have in common?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these companies, you know, they all have PM functions. They all have product manager functions. And for our audience who don't know what PMs do, right? The PMs are responsible for working with the engineers, the designers internally, as well as external parties. Like the sales team, for example, or user research groups, et cetera, marketing teams, to be able to build and launch new products and then iterate upon them to make them more efficient, make them better in terms of the core metrics. And so the PM can be considered kind of a like mini CEO inside of a product organization, helping kind of steer the ship, setting the strategy, prioritization, and execution for a particular product. Now, each of those companies that I worked at thought about PMs in very different ways. So at Netflix, it was a very PM-centric organization, which means I had a lot of control and a lot of authority to decide where we spent our time, how the product would look, and you know how to marshal resources toward that goal. I've never worked at Facebook before, but my understanding is Facebook is on the opposite end of that spectrum, where the engineers are really the ones that are kind of the guiding force, and PMs are mostly in support of what the engineers want to do. Google was somewhere in the middle, whether it was YouTube, Google, et cetera. where PM still had a significant amount of authority, but it was relatively balanced with the engineers. And so to answer your question, I think having spent those time, those 10 years building products, I got to see how different organizations thought about product development and execution. And I think they all had their own stripes of awesomeness when it came to launching successful products.
So then I guess in this case too, I mean, with Netflix, you were part of the one of the most successful initiatives that they pushed, you know, which was, I believe it was their app. So walk us through why it was so successful and how did you guys go about planning it, you know, to be the way that it turned out to be?
Yeah, no, it was an amazing experience. So I ended up joining in 2011. Steve Jobs had just launched the iPad. And Netflix's first iteration of the iPad app was just taking the desktop experience with the white background and, like, you know, all the elements that looked like a point and click using a mouse and keyboard. They shoved that onto an iPad screen where there was no mouse or keyboard. And so it wasn't really mobile responsive. It didn't look like an iPad app, but admittedly, nobody really knew what an iPad app was going to be at that point in 2011. And so we used a lot of iPhone and mobile related principles when redesigning the phone. And we actually did a couple of focus groups while designing this product. And one, actually, we came down to Mexico City because we were just launching for the first time outside of the United States back in 2011. Because before then, people don't remember this, but before then, Netflix was just a US-centric company. It was only available in the US. And so Mexico was one of our first launch countries. And so we did a focus group down there where we showed them three very different iterations, mock-ups of what we think the iPad app would look like. And of course, the one that won was going to be the most mobile responsive. You could flick through the various rows and the titles, and you can really kind of get an immersive experience. The way that PMs are geared at Netflix is on two metrics. One is retention and one is streaming hours. So my goal as a PM, I'm trying to keep people continuing to get them to pay the $10 a month for the subscription, right? It's really hard to move the needle on retention in an A/B test at Netflix, just because the numbers are so massive and it's really hard to move month to month. But the most highly correlated variable to retention was streaming hours, meaning the more minutes and hours that you stream on Netflix, the more likely you were to retain as a member month to month. So I could potentially design a system that got you into a video, a TV show, or a movie as soon as you open the app. That was my goal as a PM, to make those really great titles pop up at you. But then you'd have all these recommendations. You'd have this really great system to kind of see all the stuff that you were watching. And so it was a lot easier to kind of move streaming hours as a metric. When we launched the iPad app, and usually these A/B tests, by the way, they run for about 3 to 6 months before you turn them on for the whole population. So you only have, you have two cells. You have a control cell, maybe 100,000 people, and then you have an experimental cell for another 100,000 people. And you turn it on for maybe 3 to 6 months and you see what the data says. And then maybe you can turn it on to the entire, at that time, 30 million population. The iPad app was so successful in moving the needle on both streaming hours, but also retention after the first month. Reed Hastings, the CEO at the time, allowed us to turn it on to everybody almost immediately. And so that was just like such a rare instance of moving both of those metrics and in such a short period of time.
And by the way, I can see that, you know, the color red, you got a little bit from Netflix for those that that are not able to see this, you know, like right now, Sal has a background that is red, you know, beautiful background. But in any case, one thing that that I like to ask you too is, for those that are wondering, like, what about Sal, you know, with his entrepreneurial, you know, path and, you know, especially having, you know, been exposed, you know, at such an early age with his dad, you know, what about him? What did he think about that? So you also, you know, went at it, you know, before actually Netflix. So you went at it, but unfortunately it was not the desired outcome. And as they say, you either succeed or you learn. So what happened there? And what was the lesson to be taken with you?
Yeah, you know, I was at Google at an amazing time, 2007 to 2010, and a bunch of my friends and fellow PMs ended up starting companies. So Kevin Systrom from Instagram sat in the cube next to me. Dan Soroker and Pete Kuman from Optimizely were in the other cube over on the other side. I mean, you and then Ben Silverman from Pinterest, he was just on the other side of the floor from us. So there was something in the water, Alejandro, at Google, right around 2009, 2010. And everyone thought, oh, I can, you know, leave Google and start a company and raise a few million dollars. And so I kind of wanted to really be a part of that movement as well. So I grabbed my best friend from Microsoft and my lead engineer from YouTube, and the three of us co-founded a company called Snipply, which was rebuilding Google Reader after it had shut down. You know, that RSS reader that was really popular? They had shut that down. And that was right when Twitter was starting to get going. And we thought we could use Twitter as an amazing distribution engine to get the news out there in snippets. We called it Snipply because we're like, let's get the snippets of the news out there so people can understand, because most people don't actually read articles. They just read the headline and maybe the first two sentences of an article. And so we wanted people to be able to say, let's snip certain quotes and content within a piece of an article or a piece of content so that people can actually see what's going on in those write-ups. But it was extremely challenging to get distribution because Twitter was just literally taking that and like they had that built into their platform from the beginning where you can like write 140 words and create your own snippets and get that out there. And so we were able to build a product in a mobile friendly way, but getting distribution was super challenging. We actually had an offer to raise $2 million in our seed round back in 2010. And I had it all, I was fundraising. We had gone through an incubator. I had all the paperwork in front of me and I had a sit down with my founders who we realized were like, it's going to be really tough to build this product and build this business. And we actually declined the money. And we said, you know what? We were going to shut down the business. And so all of us kind of actually ended up going back to corporate jobs, which I think really kind of underscored maybe some of us aren't meant to be founders of startups. And some of us are meant to like really be amazing people working at other companies.
So obviously in your case, you ended up landing on Netflix, as we were talking about, then LinkedIn, and then something really interesting that is not the typical, you know, event that happens, if I may. I mean, all of a sudden you land into becoming a partner at a venture capital firm and none other than Andreessen Horowitz, A16C. I mean, one of the best VCs out there. So how did this happen? Because, I mean, that's quite a sexy move there.
Yeah, I was surprised myself. You know, I actually got a cold email from Andreessen Horowitz, and they were looking for people that had my phenotype, former product managers and former founders who could come be a part of the investment team and help the general partners source and evaluate companies and then work on those investments after writing the check. And if you actually look back at the history, so Chris Dixon, Ben Horowitz, even Mark Andreessen himself, they were all PMs in their own careers. They were building products and they were launching them at a regular cadence. And they really liked the PM phenotype there, because the PM were ones that, like I had mentioned before, are the ones that technically understand how to build products, but commercially understand how to sell them as well. And so when you obviously look at startups and you evaluate them, you have to understand both the building and the selling, obviously. And so it was actually a really great background that they were recruiting from. And a lot of my colleagues on the investment team at A16Z had product background. So let's just say I was lucky at the right time that they were growing. At the time, they only had like 50 people. I think today they have over 500 individuals at the firm, which is just insane. But I got in at a perfect time to be able to start my venture career, and it's been a blast ever since.
Hey, guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So how was that, you know, like when you guys were like now investing in companies and how did you go about treating founders too? I mean, that was quite a steep learning curve for you as well.
Very steep learning curve. The first day on the job, I still remember. So Mondays is when we have our partner meetings, right? And first day, 9 a.m., we walk in and three sets of founders, 9 a.m., 10 a.m., 11 a.m., are pitching their final pitch to the firm. And then we make a decision on whether we want to invest or not. And so everybody's around the table. You've got, at the time, I believe there were seven general partners and there were seven of us on the investment team. It's about 15 people or so in the room. And then there was, you know, the founder and his team presenting to us at that time. And they got to basically share the summation of their life's work in that 1 hour. And then we would break for lunch and then we would spend the next 3 to 4 hours discussing those companies and all the other companies that were kind of high priority. And it was just a marathon of a day because you're just going through teams and technologies and ideas and markets. And it was just intellectually so stimulating that at the end of that day, I realized I wanted to be an investor for the rest of my career. Just imagine figuring out how to do that was my goal. And so, yeah, how we treat founders was so amazing as well. I think I've talked about this on other podcasts, but there's something called the NPS score, right? The Net Promoter Score. Each one of us at A16Z, the general partners, as well as all the investment partners, had an NPS score. And what that was after you meet with a founder for the first time, and you're obviously passing on like 98% of companies, they get sent an email and it only has one question in it. How likely are you to recommend A16Z based on your interaction with Zoll? 1 to 10, right? And we were all scored and all of our numbers were published. And we had to actually make sure that founders really liked our process, even though we were passing and saying no to them. It was crazy.
Wow. So I guess in terms of, you know, Andreessen Horowitz is one of those firms. And for those that have had the opportunity of reading the book, The Hard Things About the Hard Things, is like how well they did about building the infrastructure and the value for founders. No? And I'm sure that that's something that you have taken with you, you know, as a lesson learned, you know, as you're now on the investment side of the table. But how do you think, you know, Andreessen was, and A16Z was able to accomplish getting at the top of the top on VC, like at the same level as the tier ones like Sequoia, Kleiner, that were for decades before they were even in the picture? How they were able to do it so fast?
Yeah, I mean, when I joined, we were on fund three. It was one monolithic $1.5 billion fund. Everything from seed to growth, crypto to healthcare, SaaS, consumer, all was shoved into one fund. And our entire team managed all of those different sectors and stages, from seed to growth rounds, Series D, et cetera. And you know, I think at the time, their most venture firms did not, to your point, have operating teams. So we had, I think, 5 operating teams at the time. We had an executive talent team, technical talent, marketing team, corporate development team, and a regulatory affairs team, I believe. And so the executive technical talent team are fairly clear, but the executive talent is director, VP, and C-suite, and they help you kind of fill those positions inside of your company after we make an investment. And obviously the marketing team is helping you tell your story, how to engage the press, how to deal with crises. And Margaret Wenmachers is a legend. She had her own agency called Outcast, and then Mark and Ben convinced her to come and build that internally at A16Z. And she has been one of the quiet, awesome, amazing stars at that firm and helping really create that brand and getting A16Z on the map. And then, of course, the corporate development team as well, which is all about future fundraisings and financings. The fifth team was not the regulatory affairs team. It was the market development team. And what that was is They have something called the EBC, the Executive Briefing Center, where the Fortune 500 companies of the world would come into our offices and want to meet 5 or 10 different startups during a day's time. And so it was literally a matchmaking service for enterprise and startups to come together, that the startups had an opportunity to sell their products to these Fortune 500 companies. And that still has been one of the biggest assets for the firm. And so not just the investment team, which is what Sequoia, Benchmark, all the ones that you mentioned before had, but we had this entire operating apparatus that was able to kind of help our companies succeed.
That's amazing. Now, it sounds like you were at the top of the game when it came to a segment that you were enjoying. So tell us about branching on your own. At what point did it become evident that you wanted to go at it on your own?
Yeah, you know, I think the average tenure at the firm for an investment partner is a few years. And they want you to go and help. If they want to be an investor, they're going to go and help you kind of get started. And I was really grateful to have their support. And I connected with an old friend of mine, David Lee from SV Angel. He and I were at Google a long time ago. And the two of us were both consumer guys that were getting into bio and health, among other areas at our firm and at our respective firms. And he had just left SV Angel and was looking to start something new. And the two of us started brainstorming together and decided to start this as the first, fund one back in 2016, which was a $50 million fund to go after the intersection of biology and healthcare and technology. And so, that was great. You know, I started with David, and David, by the way, has an amazing track record, if you don't know. So he helped run SV Angel with Ron Conway. He invested in Twitter, Snapchat, Stripe, GitHub, Slack. I mean, the list goes on. It's just amazing what companies he's been involved with. And he wanted to leverage that track record into building a new fund, a new firm. And so he was in LA. I was up here in the Bay Area. We were the GPs on the first fund, and then he ended up retiring. And then I ended up kind of becoming a solo GP about 7 years ago, when frankly, it really wasn't in vogue at that time. A lot of LPs were like, how are you going to do this solo? That's crazy. And I was just like, you know what? I know the types of founders I want to invest in. I want to spend a lot of time with them. I want to create a concentrated portfolio of 20 to 25 companies every fund, and really put all my effort into making those companies successful. And that fundraise, fund two for Factor Two, was extremely, extremely challenging. But fast forward a couple of years later, when I raised fund three, that was done in 5 weeks. And I just completed fund four, which was done in a similar amount of time. And so it's kind of just been great to have that, my own track record now, really demonstrate that I can actually do this solo and do it successfully.
How many companies have you invested in so far, and what are the assets under management?
Yeah, so including all the funds and all the, I've done a few SPVs as well, special purpose vehicles, where I raise those to go after certain investments. It's about $225 million under management. And the current fund size is a $50 million fund. Across 8.5 years and 4 funds, I've invested in just over 100 companies now.
Wow. Now, in your case, you're doing it alone. How is that? And how is that possible, you know, like with all those funds under management and all these investments? I mean, I know that this is kind of like a new trend of the solo capitalist, no? Where you don't need like the big firm with the big infrastructure, the big upfront cost. Why did you, you know, go in this direction? You know, why? And how are you able to do it?
Yeah. So I think, to be very, very frank and honest, you know, I had a chance to manage people in my operating career, and I just did not enjoy it, to be honest. I did not have a desire at Refactor to build a large team of principals and associates that would be working and trying to help me create something, in terms of like sourcing and evaluating companies. I'm investing in healthcare, biology, deep tech, climate tech. There's just so many categories to cover. I'm almost a little bit of a generalist when it comes to planetary and societal health. And so if I really wanted to hire somebody, I'd probably need to hire a whole cadre of folks to be able to help me evaluate these opportunities. But at the same time, I realized that would also make me having to raise a larger fund, because then I would need the management fees to actually go and pay for those really smart people because they're not going to be cheap. And so a larger fund size at seed stage is going to be really challenging because the larger the fund gets, as you know, the harder it is to create fund returners and get a multiple from that. The very best performing funds are sub $100 million funds in the last 10 years, right? Maybe there's a few exceptions to that, but the smaller the fund, the faster you can get into carry, right? The profit of the fund. And so I realized I really wanted to spend time at seed stage. I didn't want to creep up and start doing Series A and Series B investments because I really liked that initial stage of a couple of founders and a couple of employees getting a product off the ground and getting their first sales. I think I'm very good at kind of rinsing and repeating that on these 100 plus companies that I've invested in. And of course, I obviously invest at the A and the B in those businesses. But that's for my reserve checks. I spend my time at that really early stage. And so if I came back and said, okay, I can actually do this myself because so much of the evaluation is on founders themselves at the seed stage. Are they technically and commercially gifted? Are they going to be magnets for three types of people? Customers, talent, and investors. And if they can be, then that's something that I can actually help with my gut. Having met thousands of founders over the last 10 years, I can actually make that decision and make that leap on my own. Instead of getting overburdened with all the technical diligence and the market diligence, of course, I have to do that to make sure that the product has a chance to be real and to be scalable. Make sure a founder's not pulling like the wool over me in terms of, you know, a particular metric or something like that, or an opportunity. But it's all about founders and picking the very best one.
So when it comes to, for example, trends, you know, especially what you're seeing now on fundraising, you know, crazy amounts being raised in COVID. Now, you know, there's like some type of reset, you know, kick that has kicked in. What are you seeing now, you know, out there?
Yeah, I mean, the last 2 years have been actually fairly challenging for startups to raise capital because when the bubble burst in early 22, the public market started retrenching and lower, going down in price. That created a whole cascade of events where LPs, limited partners, are the ones that are investing in these funds, like mine, started seeing that the value of their investments were going down, both on the public side, but also eventually on the private side. And so there was a lot of downward pressure. And so they weren't feeling as flush and as liquid as in 2021. When Jerome Powell was flooding the market with QE, quantitative easing capital, which created obviously not only inflation, but also just a lot of jobs and a lot of opportunity post-COVID. And so when that happened, venture investors didn't know when they'd be able to go raise their next fund because the LPs were feeling a little bit more skittish because they weren't feeling flush in late 22 and obviously most of last year in 23. And so people had to extend their funds. They had to spend a little bit more time investing out of that fund. And then the next fundraise took a lot longer as well. So you just started seeing the number of deals being done year on year decline. And it just became across stages, by the way, seed to growth, but especially the growth rounds, because nobody wanted to look silly in front of their investment committees and price a company incorrectly, especially when there were no IPOs happening and the IPOs that were happening, the companies were cratering within 3 to 6 months on the market, right? And they were getting so much downward pressure as people were looking for liquidity from any source they could. And that was from a public investment, a public stock. And so private companies suffered. VC-funded companies suffered. Now it's starting to come back, which is good. The last 6 months, starting from January, I've just felt like there's just been this new energy, whether it's in biotech, climate tech, or deep tech, which are the areas that I spend the most time in today at Refactor. But obviously, AI is white hot. It's getting a lot of interest, and there's a lot of inflated valuations probably on that front as well. But I have seen it come back a lot in the last 6 months, which has been really positive.
So then I guess, you know, let me put you here into a time machine and I bring you back in time to that moment that you're thinking about starting your own business, coming out of Google. And let's say right as you're coming out of the, you know, Google office after giving your notice, you're able to stop your younger self right there on the spot. And you're able to give that younger self one piece of advice before launching a company. What would that be and why, given what you know now, you know, after dealing with all these founders and seeing all these investments, making mistakes yourself, you know, what would you say?
I would say even before I gave my notice, I would have said, okay, let's make sure that we understand what the commercialization and distribution model is going to be for our company. and maybe even think about building a different product that we knew how to build and we knew how to sell it. And so I think relying on advertising revenue, which I had known from YouTube and Google, was kind of the old style business. Now people are willing to pay for high quality content, and people are willing to pay out of pocket for a lot of different products and services. So I would say let's have that commercialization talk first before we have the product talk.
I love it. So Sal, for the people that are listening, you know, for those founders that are like, oh my God, I would love to have a chat with Sal, you know, and reach out, you know, what is the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Yeah. So, you know, I go to my website, refactor.com. It has my thesis on there of the areas that I'm very excited about. Like I mentioned, biotechnology, healthcare, climate tech, anything deep tech, IP centric, that's maybe coming out of a university or spinning out of another company, or just a couple of smart founders that have found a really new and novel way of being able to leverage an old technology in a new and different application. Those are the founders that I want to meet. And so there's a form on our website. Feel free to fill it out and send me your deck. I'd love to, I respond to every one of those that come through. The only person that sees that is me. And so I get a chance to review that and decide which companies that are really, which companies and teams are really exciting and ones that I think could be a good fit for my thesis.
Amazing. Well, hey, Sal, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today with us. It has been an absolute honor.
Thank you so much, Alejandro. I really appreciate it.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.